So this is a transition point in the retreat, and less than 24 hours, this will be no more. This room will be back into a hostel, dining room, living room. It won't be a meditation hall anymore. And we'll all be on our way home or at home, depending on where we live. So this transition to home, as Gil said, in some ways the retreat is just beginning. And I think in more ways than one, because when we think of this often when we're engaged in the kind of work that we do here, we think of this as the real work or the hard work somehow. And yet the practice in daily life is, it can be a beautiful and deep part of our practice, and yet it is quite difficult. So in some ways this is the practice, I think of this as the practice for that. So in some ways our retreat is just beginning. So I'd like to talk today about practicing in daily life, how to do that, what it means. This is something that I love to talk about. It's a big part of my own practice. In fact, when I began my meditation practice, I couldn't even envision sitting. You know, it wasn't something I was interested in at all. And yet I was very interested in understanding my mind. When I first met mindfulness, someone had sent me a book, and I had read this book about mindfulness, and I was very interested in understanding my mind, because my mind was leading me down the garden path to suffering so regularly that I was very interested in trying something. I actually felt like I'd kind of hit bottom. It's like, well, you know, I don't know about this mindfulness stuff, but it sounds interesting. Maybe this will help me. And so I was very interested in understanding my mind, but not at all interested in meditation. I didn't think I would ever want to sit and meditate. And in fact, the friend who sent me the book, when she sent me the book, she said, oh yeah, I just did this day long with this teacher in Palo Alto, and I really liked it. And I thought she'd gone off the deep end. Why on earth would anybody want to spend a whole day meditating? That was my thought. I didn't say anything to her, but she said, do you mind if I send you this book? And I said, okay, you can send me this book. And I read the book. The book was Everyday Zen by Joko Beck. And you know, somewhere in that book, I got this idea that I didn't actually need to meditate. That, you know, that wasn't about the sitting so much. It was about the mindfulness. It was about noticing what happened in your life, and that was interesting to me. And so, somewhere also in this time, I'm not sure exactly where this idea came from, but somewhere I read that, in terms of practicing mindfulness in daily life, that, you know, if you just go say, okay, I'm going to be mindful, I'm just going to be mindful all day long, that it's a setup to fail. And so it helps to pick some projects, some things to be mindful of, to kind of orient the mindfulness around. And so I decided I'd do that in my daily life. I picked two things to be mindful of, to see what would happen. You know, how would this work? You know, just kind of run the experiment and see how it would work. And at that point, I was a volunteer in the Peace Corps. I was working in a development bank. And I picked two things. And the one, the obvious thing that I picked was the main emotional state that was causing me so much difficulty, which was my anger at a particular person. And I said, okay, you know, whenever that happens, I'm going to be mindful. I'm going to pay attention when I get angry. The other thing I picked was something neutral that just happened to me a lot throughout the day. I was sitting at a computer all day long at the development bank, and something that I did a lot was to switch between DOS and Windows on the computer. And I just thought, okay, whenever that happens, that's what I'll be aware of. And reflecting back, actually, you know, I just picked these two things seemingly at random when I picked these two things. But reflecting back, actually, it was a really good idea to have picked this really neutral thing along with this difficult thing, because it gave me the exploration of mindfulness in a neutral setting as well as in a suffering setting. So that, you know, in the waking up, in the switching between DOS and Windows, there wasn't a charge around that. And so I began to get a sense of the flavor of what does it mean to wake up in activity? What does it mean to be mindful in activity? And it was actually kind of a good idea to have something neutral along with this difficult thing that I chose. So I'm just going to describe a little bit about what happened to me, and then talk about how I suggest people use what I learned in your own lives. So in this first project of switching between DOS and Windows, what I noticed was that I had made this decision that this is what I'm going to be mindful of, and that days would go by and I didn't remember. You know, I remember one night I was going to bed and it was like, oh yeah, I said I was going to do that. I didn't remember once. I didn't remember once that day. And to my credit, actually, I just said, well, I'll just keep trying. I'll just keep trying and see what happens. And what I started noticing over time, over the course of several days, weeks, was that I was remembering that I hadn't remembered more times during the day. So I was getting this moment of, oh, gosh, I've forgotten. And actually, this is something that I point to when I give this kind of a suggestion. This is actually something that I suggest for people as a way to kind of structure mindfulness in daily life, to pick something neutral that happens regularly through your day as a kind of a reference point to help you recognize whether or not you're mindful. So in this exploration, you know, the remembering that you've forgotten is kind of like the waking up, and when you're in sitting meditation and you remember that you have been wandering in thought, you know, recognizing, oh, I'm not paying attention to the breath. So in that moment of remembering, that's a moment of mindfulness. And likewise, with this kind of a project, with this kind of an exploration of picking something that happens regularly through your day, the moment that you remember that you've forgotten is the moment that the practice begins. And that's a moment of mindfulness. So in that moment, just noticing, and what's happening now? You know, it's like, you can't come back to the thing, you know, like when you're in sitting meditation, you can come back to the breath right then and there. In daily life, if you have chosen something like this, you can't come back. It's like, I'm not going to go sit down at my computer and switch between DOS and Windows so that I can notice that I'm doing that. But I can, in that moment, recognize, oh yeah, here I am. I'm present. I'm aware right now. So that moment of remembering is a moment of awareness. It's a moment of mindfulness. Very similar to the moment of waking up I was talking about the other day. Really helpful to just notice it as a moment of mindfulness and not need to be judgmental around it. Celebrate. Awareness has returned. So the way this unfolded over the time for me was I was just continuing to notice that I was forgetting, but I was noticing more during the day that I had forgotten. And at some point, I began recognizing that I was actually starting to notice kind of close to the event. So, you know, I had switched between DOS and Windows and started doing something else. And, just a couple minutes ago, it happened. And I began recognizing over the days that the mindfulness was kind of getting closer to the chosen task that I had set for myself. I was getting more of these moments of mindfulness, more of these moments of remembering. And actually, another thing that's key about this practice is in every time that I remembered that I'd forgotten, one of the keys was to just say, I'm just going to keep trying. So that quality of resolve to just keep trying, even though you've forgotten more than you remembered, just keep trying without any sense of judgment about it. And at some point, I remember on one day, it's like it happened, and then a split second later, it just happened. And I was kind of taking encouragement from the fact that the mindfulness was approaching, it was getting closer to the event. So I was thinking, well, there's some kind of progress happening here, you know. I'm getting this a little bit at least. And then one day, it's like it happened. Right as I was switching between DOS and Windows, I was awake. And it's just really ordinary. You know, this what I'm talking about, this waking up, it's really, really ordinary. You just wake up into sitting at your desk. You know, it's not like some mystical state or anything. It's just awake, present for ordinary reality. So in that moment of remembering and being mindful, it's not like you need to do anything deep or probing with that mindfulness. In fact, I recommend the opposite for people in their daily life practice, that the mindfulness have a really light touch. Just notice what is obvious in the experience of coming back into mindfulness. Just notice what's obvious. And actually don't even try particularly to hold on to the mindfulness. I find that if people create too much of a project out of the mindfulness itself to say, okay, I've become mindful, I've got to try to remember to stay mindful. If they add a lot of heaviness and weight to the practice, basically it falls away because people feel like they don't have enough time to do that. You know, it's like it adds a burden to your day. And so one of the keys for me and for the times that I teach daily life practice is this can't be a burden. You know, it's got to be really light. And it actually doesn't have to be a burden because that moment of remembering, that moment of waking up, it's effortless. It doesn't weigh anything. It's just coming back into mindfulness. So partly the daily life practice is about beginning to recognize that moment of coming back into mindfulness more and more. And I found using this kind of a project, picking something neutral that happens regularly through your day, and for me, this project, the first one that I picked, happened about every 10 or 15 minutes during my workday. So that's a lot. I mean, it happened a lot. And it really started to create a thread of very light mindfulness through the day. Just this thread, a light touch of mindfulness through the day. So as continuing this practice, what I noticed around the time that I first began to be aware as I was switching between DOS and Windows was that action of switching between DOS and Windows. As Gil was talking about this morning, there's an intention that happens before we do something. And I began to notice that intention, you know, about to do something. And that action itself of switching between DOS and Windows became like a mindfulness bell. It's like, wake up. So every 10 or 15 minutes, I got this, wake up, wake up, wake up. And also, you have a little bit of an opportunity to explore this aspect of intention with this kind of a practice. Sometimes people say, well, why don't I just set my iPod to ring every 10 minutes? And that's a great thing to do. I'm not going to say you shouldn't do that, because it does give you a support to wake up. But this kind of a practice where there's kind of an action that you're doing, that you're choosing to wake up for. So the switching between DOS and Windows was an intentional action on my part. With that kind of a project or that kind of a practice, you can start to also explore this area of intention in your daily life. It's something that we often don't talk about on retreat until we're kind of settled, because it's a subtle experience. It's hard to see. But you can see it in your daily life. You can see it in your daily life. And so in that moment of doing that activity, you can see the intention. You can see that impulse to do. And you can also see the motivation, usually. You can see the reason why you're going to do it. Now, switching between DOS and Windows on the computer usually had some kind of work-related motivation. But, you know, you can pick many different kinds of projects for this kind of regular event through your day. Something like standing up is a great one. And that, looking at the intentions behind standing up, can be interesting. You know, you're sitting at your computer, and you stand up. You know, that it may be that you're standing up from a fairly neutral reason of needing to go to the bathroom or get a glass of water or something like that. But it also might be that you're standing up because you're so frustrated with that computer that you can't stand to sit there anymore. And so there's that aversion that's motivating the movement. So you can start to see the intention as you explore this kind of practice. So it's a really, really helpful practice. The other piece of it too, I mean, you're all pretty experienced meditators, so you're relatively familiar with this moment of remembering, this moment of waking up. But I often teach this also as it's a kind of a pointer to this moment of waking up. Every moment that you remember that you've forgotten, that's a moment of waking up. And to get familiar with what that feels like, as we get familiar with what that feels like, more and more through the day, we begin to wake up as that moment happens for us. As I was saying the other day, that moment happens spontaneously for us a lot. It happens way more than you know. And as you get familiar with what it feels like to have that happen, it starts pointing itself out to you. So this is actually my main daily life practice right now, is noticing that moment of remembering, and then just kind of writing it. I don't particularly try to hold on to it, but it's kind of like, oh, I'm awake, and how long am I awake for? You know, it may last 30 seconds, it may last 3 or 4 minutes. Just kind of not making it heavy, but just like, oh, here I am, you know. And it comes, it's like magic, you know. It comes into being, you know, walking down the street or reaching for a glass or reaching for a doorknob, and there I am, my arm's moving through space. It's like, oh, wow, there it is. It's moving. So this the moment of remembering can be a great mindfulness practice in daily life, supported by using some kind of a task or a project to help you know whether you've been remembering. So the second task or project that I picked, that of looking at my anger, this brings in a kind of another angle to the daily life practice that I often like to encourage people with. I think part of the reason why my daily life practice was so strong, I mean, that first, I basically did this daily life practice exclusively for the first 3 months or so of my practice. And in that exploration of these two activities, the DOS and Windows and the anger, and then some other things that I may mention, a few other things I worked with, I began to really understand my mind and how my mind created my suffering. And I had some really deep revelations, essentially, around the choice that I had around the suffering. And at some point, you know, I think it was about 3 months in to this practice, I thought, well, you know, this is really useful stuff. I'd had some kind of mind-blowing recognitions around the anger. And it's like, wow, this stuff is really, really powerful. Maybe the reason they call the sitting practice, maybe the reason they call it practice is because it's what you practice in order to be able to do this more easily in daily life. And so I thought, well, okay, if this is going to help me do what I'm doing in daily life, I'll start doing sitting meditation. And that's when my sitting meditation began. Is when I thought, okay, this may be supportive for my exploration in my daily life. So I came at it a little backwards from some people in a way. So I like to encourage, I mean, I think a lot of the reason why the daily life practice was so potent for me was that I was really motivated. The anger that I was experiencing was making me non-functional at times. I would get so angry that I would find myself sitting at my computer just frozen in a rage, you know, just having stopped even moving because I was so angry at this person. So the anger was really, you know, getting in the way of my life. And I was highly motivated to understand this anger. And nothing that I had done up to that point was helpful. And this friend having sent me this book, it's like, well, you know, nothing else has worked. I might as well try this mindfulness stuff. And I think I mentioned this the other day that, you know, the little piece of wisdom I got out of this one book that my friend sent me, try observing your emotions instead of acting on them. That was the little bit of wisdom that I was using in this exploration. I didn't know much about mindfulness. I didn't have any instructions about paying attention to the body or, you know, letting go of thoughts. I mean, I was in the South Pacific. I was in the middle of nowhere. There weren't any meditation teachers. I had this book, and it was a little bit of a mystery to me what mindfulness actually was. But I thought, okay, I'm just going to see what happens. And over the course of months, even with very little in the way of tools, just the simple recognition, oh, this is anger. This is anger. And actually, I remember the first time I came into recognizing that it was anger. I was in a full-blown rage because, you know, anger escalates. So by the time I remembered, I had said, I'm going to pay attention to this. I was really, really angry. And I remember thinking, wow, okay, I said I was going to pay attention to this. What does that even mean? You know, I had no idea what it meant to be mindful of something that intense. It's like, yeah, okay, I'm angry. What do I do with this? And at some point, I think it's like I sat there for like, you know, 30, 40 seconds, maybe as long as a minute, and I said, well, I guess I go back to work. And I went back to work. And in retrospect, that was actually pretty powerful. Because it, you know, in retrospect, I see that recognition had cut into the flow of the anger and allowed me to go back to work. It had allowed me to kind of, you know, put the anger aside and just get on with the day. That was huge. That was huge. And over the course of months, it kept revealing more and more about the anger to me and more about how it was created in my mind. So I like to suggest for people in daily life practice, pick something that you're motivated to pay attention to. Because the motivation was key for me in that situation. I was really motivated to understand the anger. So pick something you're really curious about. And it may be, you know, something simple like, why do I always, you know, procrastinate on the computer? Or it might be something, you know, more deeply ingrained, some more a deep, powerful habit of reactivity that you're really interested in understanding, a recurring emotion, a depression, an anger, a fear, something that you would like to understand and begin to get a handle on in your daily life. Now again, I recommend very light touch on this when you notice this kind of a pattern occurring. You know, again, there's the sense of resolve, the sense of saying, I'm going to just try to pay attention to this. That's an important part of this, you know, just keeping resolving to try, even if it feels like it's not going very far. Just noticing in a moment when you notice this experience coming up, whether it's fear or anger or procrastination, when you recognize it, okay, procrastination feels like this. You know, kind of the obvious of it again. Not digging, not feeling like you've got to pick it apart or figure it out. It's just like, okay, procrastination feels like this. Fear feels like this. And again, light touch. Go on with your day. You know, don't try to hold on to it at that point. You've got things to do in your day. So you've noticed, you've come into mindfulness around that. Just take in what you can. Over the course of days, of weeks, of even months. I mean, I worked with the anger 2-3 years. After several months, there were some very deep insights that really gave me a lot of space around it, but it continued for a couple more years. I kept working with it in my daily life. Just keep looking at it. Just keep exploring. Every time you come into awakeness around that pattern, it's like you get a little bit more information about your mind in that pattern. You get a little bit more piece of the puzzle. And you don't have to try to put it together so much. It's just kind of like data gathering. You know, you just, okay, here's another little bit of data. This is what fear feels like in this situation. This is what fear feels like in this situation. Over time, an understanding can grow over a repeated observation. And I'll give you an example of this. This happened kind of over the course of, I don't know, maybe a week or so, a week and a half. It was around the same time that I was exploring the anger. But I was finding that there was a lot of loneliness at that time. And in particular, the anger was at a boyfriend who had broken up with me in a particularly unskillful way. And I was lonely a lot, you know. And going to bed at night in particular, I was really lonely. And that didn't particularly surprise me, I'll tell you. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, I'm going to bed at night alone. You know, of course I'm lonely. But I was interested in observing my emotions, and so I just started observing loneliness. And I had seen this pattern of it happening at night before going to bed, so I kind of was just checking in. As I was getting ready for bed, what happens? How does the loneliness come up and things like that? And so I was observing this night after night, noticing the loneliness come up as I was going to bed. And one night, I was setting my alarm clock to go to bed, and it was very clear. The loneliness arose as I was setting the alarm clock. It was like some connection. It was just like, that's weird. Why would I get lonely when I'm setting my alarm clock? I didn't know. I mean, I didn't see it that night. But I just, you know, noticed the loneliness and just kept going on. And night later, I don't know, a couple nights later, something like that, again, setting the alarm clock, seeing the loneliness. But I saw actually a thought flit through my mind as I set the alarm clock. A little digital clock that I had, a little digital alarm clock. And what the thought that flitted through my mind was being with my ex-boyfriend in Disneyland, looking up at a clock, at a marquee that had a digital clock on it. And so there was a connection between, I saw the kind of stimulus connection, associative connection between the sense impression and the memory. And I could see that the loneliness was a reaction to that memory. So this was new information. You know, I had thought that it was the going to bed that was making me lonely. But it was this fleeting thought about, oh, poor me, I'm never going to go to Disneyland and have a good time again. You know, Disneyland is forever spoiled for me, and I'm never going to be happy again. I'm never going to be having good times again. That was what the loneliness was about. It didn't have anything to do with going to bed. That was a surprise. But actually, what was more surprising was the next night when I went to bed and set my alarm clock. The memory came into my mind, but the loneliness did not. And I attribute it to, you know, again, thinking back on it, reflecting back, because the mind had seen the link. It's seen the cause and effect link between memory and reaction to memory leading to loneliness. The mind just said, don't need to do that. Don't need to go there. I didn't do it. I was surprised that I didn't get lonely. And actually, that regular every night loneliness going to bed stopped after that point. Now, I'm not saying I didn't get lonely. I mean, obviously, I got lonely. But this kind of regular event of going to bed and getting lonely, that stopped. So this kind of repeated exploration around a pattern can really reveal a lot to us. That particular one fell away, you know, within the space of 2 weeks or so, you know, that particular exploration. Others I've explored, you know, months, years, continue to explore. For instance, the pattern of impatience. It's a very powerful one for me. So just continuing to, you know, pick something that you're interested in. Interest is so key. And using it, we can come, very, very deep insight can happen in our daily lives. Very deep insight. Huge shifts. I would say there have been as much deep insight and shifts for me in my daily life around my habitual patterns and tendencies that lead me into suffering as have happened on retreat. I love both. I mean, I go off for months to Burma and practice, and I, you know, do the daily life practice. To me, they're a beautiful complement. They really feed and support each other. So I've got three or four other things I can talk about now. I'm just trying to decide which way to go. I think since we've been talking about the seven factors, I'll mention another aspect of this practice of choosing something that really interests you. Often what really interests us is our suffering. You know, we're interested in being free of suffering. And, you know, in this orientation, I think Gil mentioned this the other day, you know, in this orientation to looking at our suffering, we often miss that, you know, even as we're cultivating mindfulness, we often miss that there are these other qualities that are being cultivated along with the exploration of suffering. So in the attention to suffering, you know, the mindfulness is being cultivated, and the energy is being cultivated, and the investigation, the quality of investigation is being cultivated. So if you can, in this exploration, I found in this exploration of a pattern, start to take an interest in the qualities that are kind of coming along for a ride with the mindfulness. You know, perhaps a sense of confidence that you can meet a difficult pattern in your daily life. That's related to faith. Or perhaps the sense of curiosity and interest, which is related to investigation. you might start noticing that you can sustain your attention for a little bit longer on something, and that's related to concentration. You might even start to sense joy in the being able to meet something as it's arising. That's a kind of an interesting experience. Oh, here's suffering, look at that, and feeling the joy around being able to meet it. So, you know, kind of allowing yourself in this exploration to be open not only to the understanding that comes from exploring the pattern, getting to know your mind and how it creates that suffering, but being open to seeing the beautiful qualities that are also being cultivated. Another, I probably only have time for one more kind of technique or tool. This is actually one of my favorites. So sometimes in our exploration of our minds, you know, we're interested in cultivating the wholesome qualities. And we see these unwholesome qualities that are kind of opposed to them. You know, so there's you know, patience is a beautiful quality, and impatience, which is opposed to it. There's, you know, lists of these qualities, the paramis, the generosity, kindness, truthfulness, wisdom, energy, resolve, and equanimity. Whole list of beautiful qualities that are helpful to cultivate. And sometimes I've seen that, you know, one way to cultivate a quality, so cultivating by a way to cultivate patience, for example, is to study what gets in its way. You know, study impatience. And another way to explore this is in noticing the impatience, in being with the impatience, or being with this opposite quality, to notice how it impacts your behavior. Again, this is a kind of intention. This is a link of intention that when there's something happening in our minds, so impatience in this example, you know, impatience is happening. It impacts the behavior. When the mind is impatient, the body behaves impatiently. When the mind is agitated, there can be a kind of an agitation of the body. And something that I began exploring as I explored impatience in my own practice, I remember at one point I was really interested to explore this impatience, you know, so I was dedicated, yep, this is what I'm going to wake up for, and going along, noticing it. It was everywhere. Like, it was happening when I was brushing my teeth. This is not worth my time to get on with things. So, you know, there was this kind of undercurrent of impatience that was everywhere. And I remember one day I was walking down the sidewalk and feeling this impatience come up, and the very next thought was, I've been looking at this impatience for 2 months. When is it going to stop? Okay, there's some more. I had to laugh, you know. But anyway, so in exploring this, I began to really see the physicality of impatience being expressed in the body. And one day, I was in the Long's drugstore, and I was noticing that I was impatient as I was walking through the store. I, you know, had some place to get to or something, and I was like picking things up off the shelf and throwing them in my basket. And it's like, wow, yeah, I am really impatient here. And I thought, what would happen if I just acted as though I were patient? So I changed my behavior. Now, I didn't suppress the impatience. This is important. You know, if you're going to do this kind of change the behavior, it's kind of more along the lines of, how can I behave as to not let this impatience leak out into my activities? not at all repressing the mind state that's happening, but just seeing if you can change the behavior. The first time I tried this time in the longs where I was throwing things in my basket, it's like, okay, yep, okay, impatience. And I could feel the impatience, and it was a little hard to move slow, but I slowed down the motions, and I, you know, picked something up very calmly and put it into my basket. It took about 30 seconds for that impatience to go away. Just through that shifting of the body. And so this is a really interesting exploration. You know, we can cultivate beautiful qualities through behaving in a way that reflects that quality. Now, as I said a minute ago, I'm going to reinforce this. It's important not to put it on in your mind. Oh, yes, I'm a patient person. Oh, yes, this is a patience. No, it's really clear to know, no, I'm behaving in a way that will support this quality to grow in my mind. So that you're not deluding yourself, and that you're really using behavior as a, again, this is through intentionality. This is behaving in a way that supports the intention of that quality. So behaving in a way that supports the intention of patience begins to cultivate patience. So you can do this with many, many qualities. And this, to me, there's a kind of a reflection of this in a way in the suttas around this notion of modeling. Essentially, what we're doing is practicing the goal. You know, we're modeling the behavior of what we are aspiring to. And there's a beautiful section in the suttas that kind of implies this in a way. I'd like to read some of this to you. This is from one of the oldest texts in the Pali Canon. At least it's generally understood. The language of the text in the Pali is in a very archaic form, and the teachings are very, very simple. There's not any mention of the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. There's no lists. It's very simple. It talks about clinging and letting go of clinging. And it talks about what a person who is awake or free or released. Released is used a lot in this text, the word that Gil used last night. Someone who has released. What they are like. And then it talks about how you might practice. How should one who's practicing to be that person, how should that person act? So I'll read first what it says about, a little bit about the person who is peaceful. It says, this is a questioner asking the Buddha, having what vision, being of what character, is one called peaceful? Tell me about the Supreme Person. And the Buddha responds, a person who is not rooted in the past or the future, nor defined with regard to the present, and who is free of yearning. A person who is not angered, not frightened, not boastful, and not worrying, who gives wise advice, is not agitated, is careful in speech, a sage. A person who does not cling to the future nor sorrow over the past, who finds seclusion amidst sense contacts and is not led astray by view. A person who is retiring, not deceitful, not covetous, not selfish, not impudent, not arousing contempt, who does not engage in malicious speech. A person who does not relish pleasure, who is not conceited, who is mild and of ready wit, who is not credulous and not bored. A person who is free of attachment, who knowing Dhamma is not attached, someone in whom no craving is found for either life or not life, this is someone I call peaceful. And I've only read a small portion of this. It actually goes on and on talking about the beautiful manifestation in this world of what a peaceful person who has let go of craving is like. Very tangible description here. It's not anything mystical. It's just this person is peaceful. They don't crave. They're not led astray by views. Very, this worldly description of someone who is awake. And the description of someone who had to practice. Basically, you know, the description is, it will sound a little familiar. It's basically, behave like that person. So here's what it says. The questioner says, "Now, Venerable Sir, speak about the path of practice, about monastic discipline, and about samadhi. A person should not have covetous eyes. He should close his ear to ordinary chatter, should not be greedy for flavors, and not cherish anything in the world. In whatever way she is affected by sense contact, she should not lament over anything, should not long for continued existence, should not tremble amidst danger. Being meditative, one should not be footloose. One should desist from worrying and not be indolent. One should live in lodgings where there is little noise. She should not be given to oversleeping. Being zealous, she should be given to wakefulness. She should abandon laziness, deception, merriment, various kinds of amusements, and anything else like it. He should not be a boaster, should not speak scheming words, should not make a habit of impudence, should not utter quarrelsome speech. One should not be moved to tell lies, should not be deliberately treacherous, should not despise others for their way of life, for their wisdom, or for their moral conduct and religious practices. If contemplatives or ordinary people irritate with their talkativeness, one should not respond harshly, for the peaceful do not retaliate." And I think that kind of encapsulates it. You know, if you want to cultivate peace, behave peacefully. So, I leave you with this idea, this thought, cultivating not just in meditation on the cushion, on retreat, but all through your lives, these beautiful qualities of awake. Let's just sit for a minute. Thank you for your attention.